haunting music should be played as these words are spoken. Moses went up under the cloud-covered Mount Sinai, where the glory of the Lord had settled, and entered the cloud. Dating from 565, St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of the traditional Mount Sinai is the oldest continuously inhabited Christian monastery in the world. The mountain itself was snow-covered as we walked up it about this time of year, the final 500 steps difficult in the snow because the steps are only about an inch deep, carved out by a monk 1,000 years ago for some kind of penance. Being on top of Mount Sinai in that wilderness is like looking down on the craters of the moon, its ancient monastery barely visible 7,497 feet down. It was on the old Roman road in the Judean wilderness east of Jerusalem that I experienced what it was like to enter a cloud. As we walked in meditative silence on the edge of the hill, I became aware of a puffy white cloud bank far to the west drifting toward us on our left. As the cloud enveloped us, it became hard to see, dangerous, very spooky, made even more so when we were startled by a colony of birds suddenly taking flight from the cliff below. I kept thinking I was going to hear words from on high, "This is my son," or something like that. Banias, the Roman name Caesarea Philippi, was an ancient pagan holy place with the Jor River flowing out of a large cave, joining with the Dan River 8 miles south to become the Jordan River. Did you ever know that? The Jordan River. It was at Caesarea Philippi that Peter had claimed Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of the living God. 6 days after that experience, Jesus and his disciples left those Golan Heights, heading south toward the Galilee. On the way, they walked to the top of Mount Tabor, another ancient holy place. I must tell you, it's scary going up Mount Tabor, not because of any mystical aura, but because the taxis drive up the narrow, very winding road at breakneck speed with no guardrails. We walked down. Mount Tabor rises up out of the Jezreel Valley, not too far from Mount Megiddo. Incredible symbolism because of the difference between the two. You see, Tabor is a real natural mountain. Megiddo, a mountain made of 23 cities built and destroyed, one on top of the other, which is why the book of Revelation represented it as the place where the end of the world would happen. You see, in Hebrew, Mount Megiddo is literally Har Megiddo, Armageddon. Inspiration versus destruction. So, what to make of the disciples' experience we heard in the gospel concerning the transfiguration of Jesus? My British friend Canon Trevor Pitt notes, "This is a symbolic story. Moments at which earth and heaven, present and future, come together." Connecting Jesus with Moses' experience on Mount Sinai, Matthew never met a mountain he didn't like. But there's more. In the story, Jesus takes with him Peter, James, and John. Now, note Matthew's pattern of holy triangles. Peter, James, and John experience another threesome, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. Plus, Trevor reminded me that in Jewish tradition, Moses and Elijah will appear at the end of history. So pondering this story, I had, I think, a transforming insight as it dawned on me the disciples' realization that Jesus' teaching were totally connected, embedded in the law and the prophets, the same traditions as Moses and Elijah. In other words, sacred continuity. I came, Jesus said, not to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And the only way to express their internalization, the transformation of their own understanding, was through a story of transfiguration, not in nature, but in themselves. A new vision, as they saw the implications of what Peter had realized, Jesus is the Messiah. By the way, I don't know if you heard it this morning. Peter affirmed this thought in his second letter that we heard this morning. You will do well to be attentive to this as to a lamp shining in a dark place until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts. For me, that's where the transfiguration happened and happens, not in history, but in your hearts. How do you internalize that? Remember, we're talking about meaning here, not history. Nothing the eye could have seen at all. As Trevor again described, the disciples came too close to the sheer blazing reality of God. Growing up, I kept thinking I was supposed to experience something weird and wild, like the story of Samuel being called by God, Shemuel, Shemuel, scared that I might hear, Ernest, Ernest. I still get shivers thinking about that. For me, faith came more from my wrestling with reality than it did from inspiration. Like some Bible stories, faith came more as a quiet realization, an affirmation, than an objective event. Though I don't personally believe the transfiguration occurred objectively, I can show you exactly where it happened, going to a specific spot in a bunch of trees behind the basilica every time I've been there. Go figure. But cultural religion can interfere in negative ways. My wife Jill had scraped her leg getting to a felucca, an Egyptian sailboat on the Nile. And following a rare rainstorm in the Sinai wilderness, Jill, going around a rock, stepped into quicksand. And you know your wife's screams. The wound became infected from an amoeba living there. She had to have surgery for it. So as we walked around the Church of the Transfiguration, she was holding onto my arm. One of the Orthodox priests came up to us and said sternly, no touching. I learned a man holding my arm or hand would not have had that problem, but not women. I said, my wife has an injured leg. Even louder, no touching, just resounded through the basilica. Even in holy places, we have to be sensitive to cultural customs. Imagine all the social and worldview differences that have occurred since the time of Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. How crucial it is to recognize such differences. Understanding Scripture in cultural context to distinguish between momentary custom of the age and the eternal spirit. The lack of that distinction gets the church in lots of trouble. Of course, we'll never know what happened when the disciples experienced Jesus transfigured that day. But we do know this. Whatever happened, it was so real to Peter, James, and John, they couldn't shut up talking about it. And here we are. 2,000 years later, still talking about it. That experience changed their lives as they realized a way, a vision of life, which was worth living for, ultimately worth dying for. That's pretty awesome. When I received Trevor's note last night on my computer, I liked his final paragraph better than mine. So I'm going to quote him. Lent begins this week, at the end of which we shall hear how Jesus takes the same three disciples away again, this time to a garden. It is the same story. Again, Jesus prays alone. Again, the sheer reality of God is revealed, this time in his acceptance of pain and suffering. Both times, the disciples shrink from it in terror. Our Christian faith is lived between those two stories. Every disciple of Jesus can find in him the full glory of God, as long as they can face the fact that the dazzling freedom of God and the loving vulnerability of God are one and the same thing. In Jesus, we find them both, woven together without difference. To follow Jesus is not simply to move from one reality to the other, which would be far too facile. In the end, we follow Jesus because in him, all truth, all reality holds together.